Welcome, everyone. As Sharon said, my name is Katie Trebling-Sampson.
I'm Chris.
And we both serve as pastors in Washington, D.C., and have been speaking about our experience with public witness on the congregational level. So welcome to our second session, where we are asking the question, can we really be one? Is unity possible? But before we dig into that, we're going to start with a short Bible study. So would someone be willing to read the text on the screen? It's from Galatians chapter 3. Let's go ahead.
For in Christ Jesus, you are all children of God through faith. As many of you were baptized into Christ, have clothed yourself with Christ. There is no longer Jew or Greek. There is no longer slave or free. There is no longer male and female. For all of you are one in Christ Jesus. And if you belong to Christ, then you are Abraham's offspring. Heirs according to the promise.
Thank you. So these are the words of the Apostle Paul. So I'm going to ask you to consider two questions. First, where do you see diversity in this text? And then second, where do you see unity? So I'll flip back to the text and just ponder those for a couple seconds, and then I'll ask for you to respond.
Jew or Greek?
Jew or Greek? Okay. Diversity?
Mm-hmm.
Where else is there diversity?
Slave
or free? Male and female. All right. Where do you see the unity?
All children.
All are one in Christ.
Abraham's offspring.
Abraham's offspring.
Baptized into Christ.
Baptized into Christ.
All children of God.
Yeah, so if you look at a lot of these biblical texts that deal with unity, you can also find a lot of diversity within them too, just different people and ethnicities and genders and identities are all named in these texts, and yet there is this sense of unity that we are all called to, even in the midst of this diversity. And so we're going to be digging or using this text and a few others to kind of inform our conversation for this evening. But before we do that, Chris is going to give a brief recap of what we covered yesterday.
So yes, yeah, it's on, okay. So yesterday we covered about 500 years of theology in about 30 minutes. So that went pretty well. No, it was really interesting. It was really fun, but it is a lot going on. And so one of the things we're coming at from this class is, and just to recap a little bit of our story. So Katie and I met in seminary. We went to seminary together. We come from these two mainline traditions, the Lutheran tradition and the Reformed tradition. I'm Presbyterian. And we got to the end of seminary, and we felt a little bit of this hollowness, this lack of our own traditions, and we went exploring. We went on a journey to explore what else might be out there, what else might inform our theological traditions in terms of public witness. How can we live this out in real life? And then to come back and interrogate our own theological traditions in the light of other ones that we've encountered. So we looked at the theology of Martin Luther and John Calvin. We came into the 20th century. We considered the issue of the struggle of the German church during Nazism. We talked about the challenge of what happened when a weak theology had permeated German theology towards the end of the 19th century. A German theology that made God subservient to humans and made God in the human image, which it may not have caused German nationalism and Aryan supremacy, but it certainly didn't challenge them. I think that's a lesson for us to hang on today for the moment we're in our time. So we talked about the theology of Karl Barth, talked about the theology and the actions of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and then we brought it a little bit into the modern time. So that's an incredibly fast summary, again, of 500 years of theology. I want us to focus on two things. And these are a couple of ways that we are thinking about what public witness is and how faith works, what faith means for the context of public witness. So these four ideas. First, faith is personal. But what we mean by faith is personal is that faith encompasses the whole of our persons, right? There is no part of ourselves that faith does not touch. And if faith doesn't touch part of it, then somehow we're a little bit lacking in that. Faith seems to have not reached that. Has anybody ever heard of the South African idea of Ubuntu?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We are who we are through other persons. There's a number of excellent books lately. I read one by David Brooks called The Social Animal a number of years ago, if anybody ran into that, and points out that people are people, not only in the idea of Ubuntu, but it's quite scientifically verified that we are fundamentally relational beings. So all that is to say that our personal, when we say that our faith is personal, we don't mean that it's private. In fact, we specifically mean that it's public. Because faith covers our whole selves, it connects to our social world. So faith is indeed, it is necessarily public because it covers the entirety of our lives. Then we get into these two things, political and partisan. Oh my gosh, this fly is really gonna get my foot. I know, it's very, very excited about that foot there. So, gonna try to make a distinction here and speak positively about the possibility of faith being political. So if faith is public, we think it also is political because, and the way that we're defining political for this conversation and the way that Katie talked about it yesterday is that politics is how we organize for the common good, right? Politics is the location of how policy happens, how resources are allocated, how ideas are put into action for the common good. And so, by nature, because faith is public, it necessarily enters into the political realm because we are concerned. Jesus calls us to be concerned about the common good. But we make a distinction, of course, between that and partisanship. So we were talking a little bit earlier about trying to reframe the idea of political and partisan and how those two look different. Because, of course, in American politics, it's hard to divide, hard to pull apart partisanship from our political life. So here's the theory we're gonna operate with, see if you agree. So if politics is how we organize for the common good, our concern is that partisanship is how we organize to win. Right? It's distinct. Now, it feels related in American politics, right? Because we have this system where in order to get anything done, we feel like we have to win first, mm-hmm. right? But you see in the system that we seem to have fallen into, the common good becomes second to winning, right? And that's our concern. We also talked about the idea of Jesus identifying with the marginalized and taking on powerlessness in the cross. Hard to equate powerlessness in the cross with winning. Jesus decidedly lost in that moment. So I was thinking about, is there a way to think about this in terms of Jesus's life? So Jesus liked to tell, right, stories, parables, and he liked to tell lots of them about sheep and shepherds. And one of the things I've noticed is that every time he talks about shepherds and good shepherds and bad shepherds, the religious authorities seem to get really angry, mm-hmm. right? Because I think they're catching on to something. Every time that Jesus talks about good shepherding and bad shepherding, I think they're getting the idea that he thinks that maybe they're not the best shepherds of their people, right? And so they start to conspire to kill him and everything, right? So you know, he's not playing nice with the Pharisees and the religious authorities for sure. But there's another side to it as well. And I was thinking about the whole narrative around he comes into Jerusalem riding on a donkey and the people are cheering and saying Hosanna, and then of course they turn on him by the end of the week, right? And I was thinking about the road to Emmaus. He's walking with these two companions and they're walking home, and they're downtrodden and they look sad and they say, we had hoped that he would be the one to redeem Israel, right? They were hoping that he would take up arms, that he would take on power and be the one to liberate their people, and he didn't do that either, right? So I will say this, it seems like the Jesus mode of being political and not partisan, he certainly acted out a public imagination of what the common good would look like, and he certainly resisted the alliance with political partisan expediency, the desire to win. It did get him killed. So forewarned, if you kind of think maybe you want to exit this class, or maybe you're a little suspicious of the teachers because we're still alive and people still seem to like us. So, but it did seem Jesus's politicalness and yet unwillingness to participate in partisanship, in of course a wildly different context, seems to have made some people mad. So we've got these, we'll come back to any questions in a moment. We just want to make sure we're gonna get some stories today as well. So this is our working definition of what we mean by public witness. So we're drawing on the theology of Barth and Dietrich Bonhoeffer. We're drawing on the theology of many, many theologians who come from non-white and non-culturally... There's this problem in theology where sometimes we call, like, when white people do theology, we call it theology, and when other people do theology, we call it contextual theology. It's all contextual theology. All theology comes out of white people. But we're drawing on some white theologians and some non-white theologians. But our working definition is public witness, one, acknowledges that we are part of the world and its brokenness, and two, accept God's story of reconciliation in public. The first part, they go together. One doesn't work without the other. Acknowledges that we are part of the world and its brokenness. Our faith communities, our lives, they don't exist as some sort of separate from the world things. And one of the things we're going to talk about is that we're going to be good at moving our context and ourselves from wherever we are now to greater engagement in public witness. We need to understand where it is that we are failing to live into God's story and imaginative story of reconciliation, where the brokenness exists with us. Because the second part is that if we're going to act out God's story of reconciliation in public or anywhere at all for that matter, that has to come out of our failure and our brokenness itself, right? God's story, if it's redemptive, is a story about moving us from places of brokenness to places of wholeness. And so if we come from places of brokenness and not moralism, I think it helps show the world the possibilities of what a humble and enduring public witness might look like. So those are the things that's our working definition. We do want to talk about our context, which is Washington, D.C., and why we think that matters for this conversation. D.C. is a funny place, right? Because it's a symbol, right? I mean, what do you think? Okay, I'm not even going to say it. When I say Washington or D.C., what do you think of?
White House.
What? Lawyers?
White House.
White House. They said lawyers, I think of lawyers.
Yeah. Congress.
Congress, president.
Politician.
Right?
Corruption.
There we go. We got it out there. We
power.
Think power, right? Washington, D.C. is a symbol, right? For around the world, it's a symbol. And I think before we moved there, we probably would have said to ourselves, yeah, it's a symbol of all these things. And so You know, it's a place where buildings, the names of buildings connote all sorts of things. We can say the Capitol, or we can say the White House, and it comes with a whole bunch of things. And depending on how you feel about the current administration, you might have a positive reaction or a negative reaction. So the symbolic value is placed. It's got incredible public spaces. We've got the National Mall. We've got the National Cathedral. These are meeting points in our country for important conversations that we're having. And so the March on Washington, or the Women's March, or these our conversations sort of center themselves around the place of Washington, D.C. Do you want to describe this this picture here, Katie?
Yes, that or this picture is from a protest that was organized by the Franciscan Action Network and a couple other Catholic nonprofits. They brought 200 or so people together to D.C. to protest the treatment of immigrant children in detention centers. And this image is of a group of about 70 that went into the rotunda of the Rayburn Senate Office Building, and several laid down in the shape of a cross. Others recited the Lord's Prayer in the names of all the migrant children who have died in detention. And they were all arrested for this act of public witness. But again, it kind of speaks to how D.C. Is a symbol of the government speaking truth to power, and where folks come to make their voices heard.
So we came and we encountered, of course, the symbol that Washington, D.C. is, but turns out it's a real city, and we live there. So I'll tell you a little bit about our fair city. We mentioned this yesterday. We have no voting representation in Congress. So when D.C. statehood comes up, you should lobby your lawmakers. Thank you. We have, like many cities, we have dramatically increasing housing costs. We have significant poverty. We have displacement, homelessness, gentrification. We have all, if you come from Seattle, are you familiar? I mean, we've got Amazon's coming to D.C. too, and so we're all, you know, equally terrified of that. There are unique parts about being D.C. It's like many other cities. It's a little bit different, too. Many of the residents are lifelong civil servants, highly educated, committed to public service, care about the things they work in, people who work for state and the EPA, and Department of Education, right? These are people who have committed their lives to public service, and this you'll see influences deeply our how we think of working with folks who live in the city. We're a gathering place for immigrant communities, Salvadorian communities, Ethiopian communities. We have some of the best Ethiopian food in the country, so come for that. We do have countless institutions that have an interest in public life, including many faith-based institutions, setting up shop in D.C. in order to influence the public debate. So there is certainly a particular cohort of organizations and people who are coming to D.C. because of its adjacency to power. We are mostly progressive politically, like most major American cities. We also have because a lot of people work for the federal government, they believe in the value of our institutions and our laws and the structure set up, and I think that does play a lot into it. But mostly, and the reason that we think this all is valuable for people who are not from Washington, D.C. to hear a little bit about is that we think Washington, D.C. is a crucible in some ways of the American experience right now. Things are tense in your towns, and things are tense in Washington. There's an anxiety that permeates the entire city. You're sitting next to somebody who voted for the other person in the last election. In our congregations, sometimes you're sitting next to somebody who's working at the highest level in the opposite administration that you're working for. So there's this heightened anxiety, and it's become this sort of crucible. So we think that if our experience, the things that we have run into, the lessons that we have learned by being in Washington, D.C. and thinking about unity and public witness, if they've started to work for us, that maybe there are things that can be gleaned and brought back to your own context. So that is our hope, and that's why we think Washington, D.C. might be of a little bit of interest. So now we are going to talk a little bit about our particular, the context that we, oh, no, we're not going to do that yet. Katie's going to talk about
it. No, before we do that, just going to ask a question that we've kind of already touched on, but what are some of the characteristics of our public life in the United States today? Just feel free to shout things out.
Tense.
Divided.
Lies.
Angry.
Fearful.
Fragile.
Discouraged.
Yeah, so not a lot of really positive things there, right? Well, we're in the midst of times that are really challenging. Like, it can be hard to get out of bed in the mornings because it feels like we're taking so many steps back from things that we have made progress on. And it can just be so hard to even turn on the news, listen to the radio, read the newspaper, watch the evening news, and just hear all of the divisive and sometimes hateful rhetoric that is spoken. So it's not a really happy time, I guess. But kind of in the midst of this time of kind of division, the church has a very important voice to speak. And it's specifically related on the church's call to unity. So throughout scripture, we read from Galatians already today, and I'll highlight a few more, but the church has been given a very specific call to unity. Jesus calls us, or he prays in John 17, that just like Jesus and God are one, Jesus prays that we may become one. And in doing that, we reflect Jesus. We reflect, we are his disciples, his presence in the world. Mark and Mike have been working with Ephesians 4 all week. Just this call to unity in the midst of kind of the diversity of the body of Christ. We all have different gifts that we have been given, and yet we all have one Lord, one faith, and one baptism that we are called to. And again, the Galatians text that we read today, we in the many different expressions of people we are all one in Christ Jesus. So we have this call to unity that it just may seem like something that's kind of like, oh yeah, like it's another thing that Jesus says, but I think there's a lot of power in that, especially in these divided times. And as churches, as people of faith, if we can just hold on to that, look for those places in our lives, in our congregations, in our communities, where we are living out unity out of a sense of love, and we name them and we really live into them, there's a lot of power in that. And so Chris and I are going to share some stories from the ways that our respective congregations have felt that call to unity and have named it and have lived into it. So I'll hand it over to Chris.
All right. Go back on again.
There we go.
All right. So so it's unlikely. I've discovered that nobody in my congregation has ever heard of Holden, which is really too bad. I feel like, I'm going to go out to Holden next month. I'm going to teach and on unity and everything. And they're like, oh, okay. It's this retreat center in the middle of the woods. And they're like, why would you go there in the middle of the woods? So this is all to say that that means I get to tell you a secret about my congregation.
Yeah.
And I assume they're never going to find out. Although if they do, it's probably not that bad. And the secret is, I actually love them quite a bit. It's a wonderful, wonderful place. But the other half of that secret is, it's not the place I ever imagined that I would be serving when I was idealistic in seminary, right? Mm-hmm. when you're in, perhaps this is not for everybody, but when we were in seminary, I think I dreamed, I was like, okay, this is going to be, I'm going to serve a church, and it's going to be in the middle of the city, and it's going to be thriving, it's going to be multi-age, and it's going to be socioeconomically diverse, and it's going to be racially diverse, and it's going to be in the front lines of social justice, and then I remembered I was Presbyterian. The good news is I do love my congregation, and I think they've taught me so much. This is a picture that I'm especially proud of. It's a terrible, the quality is terrible. I took it myself. This is an event we have every Sunday. We host a meal for about up to about 100 folks in the neighborhood who are food insecure. We've got a band playing up with these high school students playing an amazing jazz quartet. We thought to ourselves, hey, you know, this is a place of, in Washington, D.C., we've got the Kennedy Center, we've got all these institutions, but they're often blocked to people without privilege to get in those places. So we've got this concert series going on there, and people are serving together, but anyway, so that's what that picture is. But I want to tell you a couple of things that I think we have wrestled with as my congregation, Georgetown Presbyterian Church, the things that we're not great at, or the things that are present maybe unique challenges for us. One is that we're very white, we're a relatively wealthy congregation, we're located in a neighborhood that was gentrified dramatically even as far back as the 1950s and has a long history of racial divide in the neighborhood itself and of course the city as well. And I'll count the last one as an opportunity but also a challenge is that we're what you call it a purple congregation, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. You know, Democrats are blue and Republicans are red now, right? And so you put those together, you end up with purple. So the first thing about our congregation is that we had to identify that we have some challenges and there are challenges within ourselves that we need to address. So I'll talk about a couple of the things that we did to think about some of the earlier issues, and then I'm gonna get to the purple congregation thing last because I think that is in some ways one of the most interesting parts. So this meal is one of them, right? One of the things we recognized is in our neighborhood, our neighborhood is full of multi-million dollar houses. It's also a neighborhood full of, it's one of the most forested places in the city, and it's a place where tent encampments are, it's a great place. If you want to live, or if you need to live outdoors, this would be a place in the city to go to. So one of the largest unhoused populations of the city, and the most chronically unhoused populations in the city, also lives in one of the wealthiest neighborhoods simultaneously. Mm. And I thought to myself, my goodness, wouldn't it be wonderful? I'm gonna just say that the meal, to me, is secondary. The meal is important. What's more important to me is that I know that the people back here serving know that this is Arlene, and they know Arlene's story, right? And they greet her by name in the church, and they greet her by name outside. One of the things that I think, thinking about what it means to move towards public witness, our paradigm is to think of seeing the brokenness of the world in ourselves and seeing God's redemptive story. Here's a moment of seeing the brokenness in ourselves and in our neighborhood and enacting the redemptive story of building reconciliation, bridges of reconciliation and community between people. It's not perfect and it's not anywhere near done, right? But it's a step in the right direction. And I think that's one of the things we want to hold on to the idea is taking steps in the direction and not being paralyzed by not being all the way there yet. We talked about the fact that our city is, or our neighborhood, has this history of gentrification. There are almost every resident of the neighborhood is white and there are 3 black congregations in the neighborhood as well. It's not a big neighborhood, by the way. And people move into the neighborhood and they wonder to themselves, gosh, I wonder how these black congregations got here if nobody in the neighborhood who goes to these congregations, nobody lives there, right? And so we're working on helping to tell the story of how policies enacted in the 1950s caused this early form of gentrification, before gentrification honestly was actually a word, I'll tell you a story about that, though. So similarly, my colleagues and I had a story similar to Mark and Mike's. Mike was saying that after the shooting at Mother Emanuel in Charleston, he said, I don't know what to do, so I'll send an email. So that's what we did. We didn't know what to do, so we sent an email to one of our neighboring churches, and we'd already had a relationship with the pastor there, a woman named Johnsy. So she said, okay, well, let's get together for lunch and let's talk about this. And one of the things she said, okay, I'll talk about doing a pulpit swap, having some events together. And she said, I'll do it on one condition. You need to talk about white privilege in your own congregation. You have an obligation to come to this conversation, not to feel better about yourselves, right? We're going to have a pulpit swap. We're going to have a picnic together. It's going to be great. And we're going to, you know, fix racism. You need to do some work for yourselves. You need to identify the brokenness in yourselves, with it, which is the legacy and the current presence of white privilege. Name it in your congregation, in your context, and be able to wrestle with it amongst yourselves. And then we'll get together for a picnic. That was one of the greatest blessings, I think, that we had as a congregation for Johnsy to push back and say, I will, but not yet. You've got some work to do. You need to encounter the brokenness in your context. The third story that I'll tell, and this is the one that I'm most excited to talk about. It's also the one that I actually, turns out, had nothing to do with initially. So this was all credit to one of my colleagues, Rachel, but she's not here, so I get to tell the story. So we have this purple congregation. And one story comes to mind that illustrates this. We have folks in the congregation who are working at the highest levels of the federal government on both sides, right? And we had this story. One member of our congregation came up to us and said, I can't, after the election, right? So the election happens. People were working on both sides of the aisle there. Somebody comes up and says, you know, there's somebody here, this person, who now works for the current presidential administration at the sort of the Oval Office level of the administration, and he taught my kids Sunday school, right? He's a member of my community. He taught my kids, and now he's working for that administration. I can't look at him anymore. I can't even look at him anymore. And we were like, wow, we used to believe, I think, that if we just sort of ignored our purpleness, if we ignored politics in our congregation, that everything would be fine, right? We're like, we'll just not talk about that. Mm-hmm. And we'll talk about Jesus and it'll be fine. And then we realized that was impossible. We could no longer do that. And in fact, the event of the election made it no longer possible, because people all of a sudden looked at each other, not with the love of at least co-congregants, but with this fear and even hatred, maybe. So has anybody ever had the experience of going to, you know, Christmas or Thanksgiving, politics comes up and you just want to run away forever, right? Yeah. So that's like every Sunday at congregation.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Did that happen before this administration
in
any way?
It didn't. This is, I will say, one of the unique parts of our time is that the advent of the current administration, for reasons that I don't know that they even matter what the reasons are, but it didn't happen, at least for this conversation, but it didn't happen before. We could kind of go on ignoring it before, but we can't ignore it anymore. So every Sunday was like going to, like, Thanksgiving with aunt or uncle, whatever, and you go, oh my gosh, just don't let politics come up, because we're going to murder each other. And so we did the thing that most families should do, except we did it for our congregation. We hired a therapist. Seriously. We found, we talked to a woman who is a marriage and family therapist, and she said, we're going to get together as a congregation and do therapy and develop skills for talking to each other. How do we empathize with each other? How do we hear each other's stories? How do we, here's one of the challenging things. How do we empathize? We talked about this yesterday a little bit. How do we empathize with each other without thinking that means we have to agree with one another completely? I think particularly as, I'll say for myself, as a person of a great deal of privilege in this country, I think it's incumbent on me to learn how to empathize with people who I don't agree with radically. And I think the radicalness of it is separating empathy from agreement. So learning how to talk to each other, right? Learning how to hear one another's story, learning how to hear one another's anxieties, and learning really practical skills, right? When I think about what it means to be a pastor, one of the things I do a lot of times is do premarital counseling. And one of the things that I have to do a shocking amount of the time is teach people how to talk to each other, right? Just talk to each other. We practice something called nonviolent communication. And it's relatively straightforward, right? It's the process of one person talking to another and that person simply repeating back what they heard to gain clarity, and then to ask a request of the other while using I language, right? It's relatively, without accusing somebody, you made me feel, nobody can make you feel anyway, you feel the way you feel. And so we used basic marriage and family therapy practices to be able to make it possible for, and Katie put this really well the other day, make it safe and possible to have conversations that we were terrified to engage with, right? We're like, we would rather just run out of the place than have this conversation around faith, politics, around immigration, around, what else? Immigration was an interesting one. There's another thing, we ended up talking about our story, the history of our congregation with immigration. Turns out our purple congregation had hosted like 10 refugee families over the course of the last half century. We engaged our history to help people understand that immigration and refugees were part of our story already. So why do we bring up these stories? These don't sound, to me anyway, like the conventional ways that we talk about public witness, right? These feel like, to me, like we were over here and we see public witnesses way over there and we took a step, right? And I think my hope and my gladness for the congregation is that we did take a step in the right direction, and that I hope that we continue to keep taking steps, but that we do it in a, we'll acknowledge that it's slow work. It's slow work and it's not gonna happen all overnight. So that's a little bit about Georgetown Presbyterian Church. Katie's gonna talk about her context now.
Yeah, but before I begin, I understand some folks need to leave early, so feel free to just get up whenever you need to go. So this is the congregation I serve, First Trinity and St. Matthew Lutheran Church. You'll notice that the title of our course is A Tale of Two Congregations, but we're talking about three today. And that's actually intentional because these two congregations have come together in a way that I think really kind of reflects this call to unity that Christ gives us. An open secret is I do love my congregation a lot too, and some of them may come here someday. I'm hoping to bring them here, so if they do, tell them that. No. But anyway, so the First Trinity and St. Matthew both have really interesting stories. So First Trinity is located in the judicial district of the city. So we're surrounded by the local and federal courts. It's also a neighborhood, it's not a very residential neighborhood, but we do have a lot of unhoused people who are in the neighborhood. There's a very large shelter just about two blocks down from the congregation. And so ministry to the unhoused has been a really important part of the congregation's ministry. They have a couple programs that they've started to provide services for folks who are unhoused or who are housing insecure. They also have a restaurant training program for re-entering citizens. They have a ministry to folks with of differing abilities, and also a robust hostel ministry for groups coming into the city for either mission trips or public witness and advocacy. And so kind of through all of those ministries, First Trinity became a very diverse congregation. Diverse not only in terms of ethnicity, but also ability and gender orientation and housing status, immigrant status as well. And so one member of the congregation kind of puts it, if you're something, you'll find someone else in the congregation who is the same thing you are. So it's pretty diverse in that way, which I think is a real blessing that we are just kind of uncovering how much of a blessing that is. So that's First Trinity. And then St. Matthew, who's also represented in the picture. St. Matthew is a congregation that is located in the southwestern quadrant of D.C. It's in a neighborhood that historically was, there are many public housing communities there, which are right next to kind of older, more expensive co-ops, which are right next to brand new multi-million dollar condos. So it's a neighborhood that is rapidly gentrifying. Housing security is a major issue in the neighborhood. But it's also a neighborhood that is historically African American, also has a number of people of African descent and other immigrant populations. And so St. Matthew's demographics also reflect the neighborhood. But the story of these two congregations comes together probably about a decade ago when St. Matthew's building in Southwest DC became uninhabitable. It was built in the late 60s, and from day one, it had a significant water problem. So by the time they left the church, there was this green slime that was coming down the walls. There was literally a pond with moss right in the middle of the sanctuary. So yeah, kind of gross. Not a place that is safe for anybody to worship. So the congregation realized, you know, we need to take stock of what's going on here, what's going on with our building, what's going on with us, what are we called to? And the congregation unanimously felt called to remain in the neighborhood. So then that led to a decade-long process of talking with developers to redevelop the land that the church was on to build both housing and then also a separate worship space. But the congregation didn't have anywhere to worship for that decade. So they got together with First Trinity and worshiped together for an entire decade and shared the same worship service. And, you know, over a decade, relationships develop. A shared identity develops. The choir is made up of members of both congregations. They did fellowship together, ministry in the neighborhoods together. Just, they essentially began to operate as one congregation. So I'm going to fast forward to this past January, when after a decade, this brand new building for St. Matthew Lutheran Church was opened in Southwest DC. We had a really great celebration. Bishop Eaton came out and preached, which was really awesome. But kind of leading up to that, members of both congregations were just expressing some really deep sorrow because they had really grown these deep relationships, these deep, meaningful relationships over that decade. And a couple of folks kind of put it as, like, we feel like our parents are getting a divorce. Like, we won't get to be with each other anymore. Like, this is really sad. So have two other colleagues, and so the three of us met with the church councils and decided that, you know what, we're going to try to come up with a way that we can still remain in mission and ministry together, even though we're not going to have two locations. And so we looked to that text from John chapter 17 that I summarized earlier, and Ephesians 4, and really felt that we were being called to be unified, to live into this vision of unity. And so, like, what that ends up looking like is we call ourselves two congregations sharing one mission in two locations. Yeah. So two congregations in that we still have separate names, separate constitutions and councils and budgets and all that. But we share one mission in that we see both Judiciary Square, where First Trinity is located, and Southwest DC, where the St. Matthew building is located, as our shared neighborhoods. So they're places where we do ministry together. We also share staff, a couple budgetary line items. My call is to both congregations to kind of help cement that relationship. And just a number of other ways we are one in mission. But again, we're in two locations. So we have two neighborhoods that we can connect with and do ministry together in. So we've been living into this new paradigm for almost 9 months now. And it's been really kind of exciting to kind of mind the depths of what it means to be unified in our ministry together. And one thing that we have really discovered together is, again, that diversity of both congregations. A big survey or a demographic study came out a couple of decades ago about all of the major mainline Protestant denominations and the percentage of each ethnicity that was in it. And the ELCA was 96% white. And among all of the mainline denominations, we as the ELCA are the whitest, the least ethnically diverse. And so looking at that and just looking at the diversity of our congregations, not only in terms of ethnicity, but also ability and housing status, et cetera, we've really kind of been leaning into that as, or recognizing it as a blessing. It's something, it's who we are, but it's also just this great blessing that God has gifted us with. And so we've been doing a lot of intentional work around anti-racism studies, and also our synod has a number of great resources for multi-ethnic outreach and looking at ourselves and what ways are we promoting kind of a very white dominant way of being, and what are ways that we can let go of that and open it up to other perspectives on what it means to be Lutheran and what it means to worship. So that, also, both congregations are within sight of the Capitol Dome, so we have become hosts for a number of groups that come into town to do public witness. So back, I guess it was a year and a half ago now, with the March for Our Lives, the gun violence march, we hosted a number of folks from the ELCA who came into town to march because we were about two blocks from where it was. And then St. Matthew has hosted ELCA advocacy convenings as well. So, and those are just a couple examples of different ways that we've really kind of been living into or exploring kind of what it means to be unified in our ministry together. And again, it's not kind of what one would think of when one thinks of public witness. It's not where we're not going out to the Capitol every day to protest or anything like that. But it's a way of that we are acknowledging the brokenness of the world, the presence of division in the world, and we're living into God's acts of redemption and reconciliation for the world. We are taking active, intentional steps to be unified. So Chris and I are going to share a couple lessons that we've learned from that experience, and then we want to hear from all of you.
So what is it? Okay, so this, you know, we're saying the same thing as if you've gone to see Mark and Mike. They talk about the fact that division happened intentionally. Division happens intentionally. Unity requires intentionality as well. I'm also going to stop for a second. I'm going to just echo that thing again. I feel like what Katie just said. I do. I'm feeling like that. That we made a big shift in gears. We're talking about these big ideas of public witness and Jesus being with the marginalized and standing with the powerless and political, not partisan. And then we're talking about regular things that churches do. We hope that's actually a hopeful thing for you in your context. And we're going to talk tomorrow about how to make that real. Okay, but coming back to here, it's not easy, it requires intentionality. It involves reconciliation of different ideas and sacrifice. I think we both had that experience in different ways. These two congregations coming together have had to not do the things the exact way their congregation always wanted to do them all the time. We've had to think about, for Democrats and Republicans, being able to listen to one another and being open to the stories of one another. In ways that we've often never done before.
Yeah, through unity, you can also do more together than alone. There's the African proverb that you can go faster alone, but longer together. And I think we've definitely discovered that at First Trinity and St. Matthew. Just we've been able to share so many resources and go a little farther than we would have been able to on our own. Unity can also be dangerous. It is not what we can be inclined to work toward, and so it can ruffle some feathers and rub some people the wrong way.
Make us have conversations we really, really, really did not want to have.
Yeah, so it can be a little dangerous.
It requires a particular set of skills. A little bit, these last three are connected for me quite strongly. Requiring a particular set of skills, listening and compassion, not always meeting agreement, and knowing your context and analyzing it. This may be a good way to sort of skip a little bit to thinking about what we're going to do tomorrow. And so we're going to employ some skills that we've learned through, believe it or not, the Harvard Business School, leadership skills that congregational leaders are now routinely borrowing from the business world to think about how to make change in a congregation. But as we think of them, they end up looking, thinking about moving towards a theology and a practice of public witness in a skill-based way, for me, feels a little non-anxious than, oh my gosh, we need to establish this robust theology of public witness, and then we've got to get all of ourselves completely there right now. We can do this by steps, and it's possible for all of our, whatever context we have, it's possible to move in that direction. So one of the things we're going to do is we're going to workshop, and we hope that you come back tomorrow, because what we're going to do is divide people into groups and actually workshop potential ideas, things that you can go home to whatever your context is and say, hey, here's a thing that we can do to move us from here to here. Not from here all the way to the other side of the room, but from here to here. And things that are actually actionable and contextually specific. So it means developing those sets of skills. It means listening and compassion as differing from agreement. And it also is going to be knowing your context and analyzing it, right? One of the things that each of us have had to do with our own context is understand deeply what it is that makes us tick, what motivates us, what are we afraid of, what are the conversations we like to have, what are the conversations we absolutely never, never, never want to have. All of those, understanding those things, naming them and claiming them, make it possible to move towards an actual practice of public witness in our actual context.
All right. So we have talked at you a lot this evening, so thanks for your patience, but we want to hear from you. Just, do you have any questions or reactions? Yes.
I'm quite wondering, in the two churches, do you actually preach at both churches? Like on the same day?
Yeah, so the way it works is St. Matthew worships at 9:30, First Trinity at 10:45. There are three of us pastors on staff. One presides at St. Matthew, one presides at First Trinity, and the other preaches at both locations. So it makes for a little bit of a quick drive between the two, but it works most of the time. Yes?
What did the therapist do?
Honestly, made us talk to each other, right? Made us talk to each other with basically using the things that you would, the skills that you would learn, you use in marriage and family therapy, basically.
And people came.
Well, lots of people came.
People come.
Yeah. Big group of people came. They were super fascinated with this, and it was really, I mean, I would say in some ways it was really straightforward, right? You know, think about you're having an argument with a member of your family, your spouse, or something like that, and you've come to an impasse, and you go to a therapist, and the therapist simply gives you a way of talking and a language to engage in the things that were otherwise scary to talk about. So one of them is this model of what we call nonviolent communication, and it's moving away from "you made me feel this way" with the finger wagging. It kind of removes finger wagging language and makes it about, when you said this, I felt this way. And it helps build compassion and empathy between people. And it also gives an opportunity to be heard. One of the things we force people to essentially to is you say something and it has to be repeated back. So if I say, you know, Katie, I'm feeling X way, she would simply have to say it about what I've heard you say is, and repeat it back to me in her own words, right? But so these are very simple skills. So we get people in small groups to do that.
And they knew that's what they were getting in for before they came?
Yeah, mostly.
Both sides.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
Did they respect the rules?
For the most part, yeah. You know, I think people are longing to have some of these conversations, right? They're like, I don't want to be stuck in this paradigm anymore.
Can you say more about the example you shared? The man who's
you know, okay, yeah, sure.
The administration was teaching this.
Yeah, yeah.
So has there been any those two people?
They look at each other now. They talk to each other now. I don't know, to be perfectly frank, I don't know if it's become like, well, everybody's completely repented and there's complete reconciliation, right? But they talk to each other, right? They can sit next to each other still. They can pray together still. It's a step.
Does the one man still work?
In the Oval Office?
No.
Yeah.
Oh,
he doesn't.
He doesn't work there anymore.
That's the solution.
When your congregation, the two congregations went back to the separate buildings, have both congregations stayed diverse?
Yes, they have.
Okay.
Yeah, they have maintained their original diversity and are adding to it as well. Yes.
I need some help with the word reconciliation in your working definition.
Mm.
I like your idea of we're starting from brokenness. And I'm seeing your image of the people at the rotunda being arrested. And I'm involved in environmental activism and my friends are being arrested.
Mm.
We are far from reconciliation.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure where to go with that, because when you're in the midst of it, it is so antagonistic.
Mm.
So maybe you can say something to help me visualize the more positive outcome, perhaps. Because the word reconciliation, I don't know how to plug that into the context that I'm experiencing.
Let me suggest that, and maybe see if this rings true for you. Often we think about, and I think Holden's a good place to talk about this, oftentimes we talk about reconciliation between one another. I think reconciliation with us and the created world is equally what reconciliation means. And in fact, because we share this created world, if we are reconciled to one another, we need to be reconciled to the land. It sounds like you're doing incredible and really hard work, but I think that if we were to go back to our definition, right, acting out God's story of reconciliation, I think that the proclamation that we ought to and need to care for the created order, and there's no other way, is in a way acting out the story of reconciliation. In this case, it's acting out the story of reconciliation with us and the earth. I don't know if that makes you feel more hopeful or not.
Well, shifting the reconciliation it's between us and protecting the earth versus between us and them, who are, we think, destroying the earth.
Mm-hmm.
But I was trying to think, how can I get to reconciliation with the people on the other side? Because it's
How do you define those first steps of how you move somebody incrementally toward each direction? If that's the movement that needs to happen. Mm-hmm.
I love the work of, I think a lot of people read this book after the election, love the work of Arlie Hochschild. I'm not saying that word, that name correctly, but she's a sociologist from Berkeley who spent a number of years living with Louisianans in the Bayou. And she did a sociological profile of folks who, from a deep red part of the country to one. So she's this, you know, this Berkeley, Berkeley academic, and she's spending years listening to the stories of people who are actively supporting things that she probably herself would not support, and listening to the stories of why is it that you, quote unquote, you seem to be voting against your interests, right? And getting and listening to their stories. So, I don't know that I've done this, but I would be curious to listen to the story of someone who seems to be opposed to things that we feel on environmental justice and hear their story about. Because I don't know that I know their story. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that I know how to move past where we are without knowing their story.
Yeah, related to that, a person who comes to mind is Eboo Patel, who is the founder of the Interfaith Youth Corps. And he has come up with this model for dialogue of between youth of different faith traditions. And it starts with storytelling. He roots it in a service activity as well, but he has a Jewish kid and a Muslim kid sit down together and tell each other stories of service from their tradition, and those stories can create some understanding and kind of this sense of we do have some things in common. I mean, we have a lot of differences, but we also hold some things in common, and I can now also kind of understand where you're coming from. And so I think his model of interfaith dialogue could maybe speak to this context as well. Just, I think there's kind of this conflict of values and some misunderstanding that's going on in a variety of sectors. And just creating opportunities and having the courage to kind of sit down and share those stories could at least be a step toward reconciliation.
Yes. Could you say more about speaking to your congregation about white privilege and how that has gone?
Mm.
Or in what context and how have people been able to hear that?
Yeah. Storytelling.
Okay.
Honestly, right?
Yeah.
So, Glenn was talking earlier about coming to across differences into the story of Scripture. We invited, sometimes it helps to have an outsider come and talk, right? Because people will listen to an outsider a little bit. And so we had someone we knew come in and talk about the story of, think of the Gospel of Luke and the Book of Acts and the stories of race and ethnicity around the Pentecost story, but also in other moments where race and ethnicity show up. And so it was getting into the story of Scripture and seeing what emerged out of that, and then getting into our stories and asking people, when was the first time you noticed that you were white? Mm-hmm. When is the, right? So we spent a lot of time thinking about stories, and it made people less afraid to talk and realize the ways in which they already could identify. They didn't have to be told, as it turns out, that our majority white congregation benefited from white privilege. Simply by telling their own stories, they said, oh, that's interesting, right? Yeah. So, you know, we didn't...
I think the storytelling thing can also be written on the fly. If someone says something that seems offensive, or that, you know, you might normally instinctively want to jump in and say, how can you say that? Well, that's wrong. You know, if you can just say something like, you know, I'm curious why you said that, you know, or what do you mean, or something. If you can get them engaged so they're feeling heard, and who knows what they'll answer, but at least you're letting them tell a little bit of their story, and you're learning something about them, and that, I think, is much easier to open up a dialogue rather than, don't ever say that, or something, you know, you can have more of a little bit of understanding between each other.
It's actually fairly disarming to just say the three words, tell me more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. Building bridges.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, I'm curious. There's a new term you had for homelessness. Now, what did you say?
I said unhoused.
Unhoused, yeah. That must be the latest. Anyway, I was wondering about the homeless that live in tents in the area where your church is, and they come for dinner.
Yeah.
Is it once a week or once a week?
Once a week, yeah.
Once a week. How many of those people, or if any, have started attending your church and participating in the church activities? Is there any kind of encouragement for that? I'm sure you encourage them, but
sure.
Has it been successful at all?
No, I think it's something we failed at thus far, right? I think that your congregation is a good example of a congregation who has crossed socioeconomic boundaries. No, is the answer. I think we failed at that so far, and I think that is a place that we need to identify that we are continuing to fail in. That if we believe that we really are in relationship with one another, then we need to embrace the idea that we could worship with one another. And this is sound blunt and mean. I don't mean it this way, but accept sort of the discomfort of it. And some of it is a physical discomfort. Some of it's the idea that if any of us slept outside for a single night in Washington, D.C. in the middle of the summer, we would smell terrible. It's a hot, humid city, right? Without a shower. So, right, entering into that discomfort, I think we've failed to enter into that level of accepting of discomfort yet. And so that's a place for us to think about.
Yes?
We're in a... Central City Church as well. And it was interesting because we have a community meal on Saturday. But one of the things that our pastor insisted on, which is starting to make a difference, is instead of, because we are primarily white congregation, not totally, but primarily, when someone who doesn't look like they belong walks in on Sunday morning, instead of saying, oh, do you want to see the neighborhood person, invite, say, you know, welcome to worship.
Yeah.
And we all kind of went, oh, we didn't realize we were doing that.
Yeah.
And it has made a difference. And some people are coming to worship with us simply because we expected them to. We thought we were being helpful by saying, oh, you want to see the neighborhood person on a Sunday morning, rather than saying, welcome to worship.
Yeah, that's something that my congregations have intentionally worked on, just
someone walks in the door, you say, welcome to worship, here's a bulletin. Afterwards, we have a fellowship hour. It'd be great if you could stick around and fellowship with us. And
that's such a little thing.
Yeah, right. But yeah, it can be those little things that just go quite a distance.
Right. And something to hang on to for tomorrow is thinking about the difference between solving a problem and shifting our culture. Right, and we're going to talk tomorrow about moving from the paradigm of solving problems to re-understanding ourselves and our own cultures. Right, and that's something that clearly we need to do. My congregation needs to do on this subject.
Any final questions? All right. Well, it's about time for chapel.
Thank you so much.